Let's start with Mother's opening prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, blessed Master, dearest Mother, beloved David, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king, reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Om. Peace. Yes. Amen. Do a short meditation.
Sri Hari Charanam. Shri Guru Charanam Shri Hari Charanam Shri Guru Charanam Shri Hari Charanam Shri Guru Charanam Shri Hari Charanam Shri Guru Charanam Shri Hari
Jill, I think it's your turn to read chapter 2.
Can I share one little thing that happened right before we started?
Please.
I got home and looked out onto the beach and there had been these lumps, white lumps out there before we left for an hour or so and came back and the lumps had turned into swans and there were 7 of them and they were swimming. So I think that was my birthday present from David.
Paramahansa.
Yes. Magnificent swan, right?
Supreme Swan, yeah.
Supreme Swan. Chapter 2, Papa Comes to Visit, Meeting Swami Ram Dass. Should I start with the part underneath the picture?
Please do, yeah.
I feel so privileged to have sat at the feet of 2 of the greatest masters that could possibly be in this world. How wonderful it was. One came to show me the way, to give me the techniques that would take me there, and the other put me through the crucifixion and helped me to realize to the realization of my oneness with God. I have been forever blessed, and I am forever grateful. Papa Comes to Visit, Meeting Swami Ram Dass. I went to India to surrender myself completely and utterly at the feet of God. I went through a completely realized master, one with universal vision, who had indeed come, as it says in the Christian Bible, like a little child. And he had entered the kingdom of heaven. To him, his beloved Ram was everywhere. The bliss that he experienced shone in his face, and this power in his gentle soul was so tremendous that you can't begin to imagine it. I have come to know that Papa, Swami Ram Dass, was the means of saving my spiritual life. It was as though Master had provided the groundwork, the foundation, provided the inspiration, gave me the steadiness in the path, the love for God in him, and the love for God everywhere. And yet Papa came and picked me up from there and lifted me into the arms of God. When you get to that stage, only such a one can help you, no one else. An organization cannot give it to you. An institution cannot give it to you. Nothing less than a God-realized master can help you through this final destruction of your ego. It was in September 1954 that I heard of Papa. Reverend Bob Raymer of St. Paul, Minnesota, wrote and told me that a Swami friend of his was coming to America and would visit them and then fly to Seattle, which was my home. The day dawned when Papa was to arrive. I agreed to go to the hotel and welcome him. As I stepped into the elevator to ascend to the floor where Papa was staying, I was filled with mixed emotions. Anticipation at the prospect of meeting him, and hope that I was not going to be disloyal to my own guru in doing so. I had been a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda for 25 years, and my love and devotion for God in him was so great that even the thought of meeting another master seemed somewhat sacrilegious. Let me hasten to add that this was not fostered as a result of anything my guru had said, but stemmed from my own feeling. During his lifetime, he entered Mahasamadhi on March 7, 1952. He taught all who followed him and taught us well that God was equally present everywhere, in every church and every temple and every religion, in every man, regardless of race, color, or creed, and in every atom of space. He told us that we must always pay homage to God equally in every saint whom we were privileged to meet. I left the elevator and walked down the hall to where Papa's suite of rooms was located. As I started through the door, I saw Papa. He took one look at me. His childlike face broke into a broad grin and he started dancing as though he could not contain the joy of our meeting and must somehow express it. I didn't know what to think. I had never seen anyone behave in such a manner, but then I had never met anyone like Papa. I sat at his feet and immediately felt myself lifted up into the presence of God. What peace, what joy, what bliss I experienced. He said afterwards that I had left body consciousness. I do not know. It was an indescribable experience. Little did I dream then that my meeting with him was to change the whole course of my life in order that I might fulfill my destiny. The momentous occasion of my first meeting with Papa ended with my offer to be of any service to him that I could. I also extended him an invitation to speak to our group the next evening, which he very graciously accepted. So knowing the depth of my love for my own guru, he spoke.
Do you want to stop there, Larry? Yeah, let's stop there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that...
You want me to read that last little section again?
Sure.
The momentous occasion of my first meeting with Papa ended with my offer to be of any service to him that I could. I also extended to him an invitation to speak to our group the next evening, which he very graciously accepted. That jumped out at me. It's a very dangerous thing to do. Be of service to Papa and in any way.
Yeah.
That she could.
She was asking for something she wasn't aware of. Or he took it that way, didn't he?
Mm.
Yeah, we don't know if Mother had been with Papa in previous lifetimes or not. She felt that Master and she had been. You know, Mother didn't talk very much about her other lifetimes, though she said that God had given her a great deal of information about them. I think it's I think it's interesting that Mother didn't give us a lot of context trying to prove herself through stories of that sort, but that rather she took basically the authority that she had with her experiences and with her knowledge of God and with her having a realization of her oneness with God, that she used that as her true calling card, her true strength of authority. And that was pretty much undeniable. I often have thought about that meeting with my mother with Papa, because it is such a unique story in our mind's eye as to how that took place. She talked about being lifted up in the spirit with him, meditating, and it's something that Master used to do a lot during his sadhana days. Of he would meditate and with others, not just himself. And of course, the way he taught his disciples was they did do it. They did, you know, in a group of people. I remember the first time I was at Mount Washington, sitting in that main room where they had a meditation room to the left of the door as you walk in. And probably could hold 50 people, maybe more, a little more. Very beautiful. And there's still his chair that he sat in there. Very powerful. But here's her meeting with Papa.
I find it interesting that we didn't have any inkling at that time that we put it in there that there would be a whole other book coming out that begins in the same way. I mean, that this last book, all of that is in there.
Yeah.
You know, again, once again. Mm-hmm. Mother writes it so richly, though, that I find, I picture it so well, and I have no idea what that room actually looks like. Mm-hmm. The hallway in my mind looks kind of like Mother's apartment as you come up there to go to the door. Mm-hmm. I have it so richly painted in my mind, and also even her home, which I've never seen either.
Of that era, in the place on 73rd, yeah.
Yeah, wouldn't it have been nice to be, you know, there were pictures taken of Papa on his world tour. We don't have any pictures from those gatherings. Except the one up here, I guess.
Go ahead, Jill. You can continue reading. Unless you have a comment, or anyone does have a comment, sorry.
So knowing the depth of my love for my own guru, he spoke to us on the greatness of saints. When Papa had finished his speech, I asked if he would touch the heads of everyone there and transmit his grace to them in that way. I was the last in line, and as I knelt before him, I said to him, Papa, please ask the Divine Mother to manifest within me fully, that I may be filled with the light and the bliss of her presence. He looked at me, smiled, placed both of his hands on top of my head, and said, Yes, it shall be so. Realizing the tremendous power of God in him, one can only imagine how I felt in receiving such a benediction. Realizing the tremendous power of God in him, one can only imagine how I felt in receiving such a benediction. When I arose, Papa said to me, referring to the devotees present, You have here all of your fragrant flowers together. Are you all happy now? You must, of course, feel happy. With my heart overflowing with gratitude, I replied, When God himself has come to see us, why should we not feel happy? Papa smiled a heavenly smile and said, God has come to see God. Hearing these words, the whole world seemed to stand still, because they were the fulfillment of God's promise given to me several months before, when I had offered myself to him in full surrender. The gracious Lord had lifted me into the state of Nirvikalpa Samadhi, where, fully conscious, I lived in two worlds for 8 days. moving in this state with very little sleep and almost no food. He revealed to me such wondrous things that the memory of them is forever engraved upon my soul. Then he spoke these unforgettable words, I shall meet you face to face, then our joy may be full. How could I doubt the reality of the vision? He had indeed come in Papa's form, and my joy knew no bounds. As I stood before Papa, the bliss which permeated his whole being engulfed me like a flood. It was as though I was lifted up into the arms of God, and I felt like a little child. With tears flowing from my eyes, I asked, will you be my Papa too? He smiled his ever blissful smile and answered, yes, he is Papa to all. All are his children. The day for Papa's departure arrived too soon. He had asked if we were coming to the airport to see all of them off, and I said, yes, of course, Papa. I don't want to miss a minute with you. Although the visions previously mentioned had seemed like the veriest reality, and some of them had already manifested in the outer sense, still I had great difficulty in accepting the things which God had revealed to me about myself and my own destiny. I thought surely that I must be suffering from hallucinations, and my soul underwent great torture as a result. Suddenly, I felt a compulsion to lay the whole matter before Papa, that I might have the relief of knowing the truth, whatever it might be. When I described the vision to Papa and asked him to help me either accept or reject it, he turned and, looking directly at me, said, Mother, every word that God told you was true. Then he said, there are three ways in which visions may be verified as truth. First, that they are confirmed by a saint. Second, that they are verified in the scripture. And third, that they actually manifest and become prophecy fulfilled. At the end of the time, he invited my husband and myself to visit him in India. This was in 1954. Finally, in 1957, I felt directed to do this. I was going through many spiritual experiences, and I went to India and left the organization, which I had been attached to for many years, and went under the direction of Swami Ram Dass at a place called Ananda Ashram, which means House of Bliss. It was quite a decision to go to India, and in doing so, my husband and I obeyed what it said in the Christian scriptures. That is, that you should sell all of your goods, devote every bit of your life to God. So this we did, in order that we might go to India and sit at the feet of this other great master. I owe great tribute to Swami Ram Dass, who put me through the crucifixion. When I say put me through it, I don't mean that he imposed it upon me, but rather he was the guide and the director of my spiritual progress when I was going through all of these experiences. Papa stripped me of all the things of the human in order that he might show me the truth of my soul, and I have thought many times what a tremendous service he did me. But for him, I could not tell you the truth of the cross, the way of the cross and the Christ, as I have experienced it within, because he had the courage to hurt me, to put me through the greatest of tortures in order that I might find the joy of God and the truth of being. There can be no greater love than this for any man, no greater love. Do you want to speak to that, Larry?
Why don't you?
It's easy to be kind to those we love, isn't it? To know what's for our greater good and for everybody's greater good. And then be willing to stand by and guide her through that. You think about the hardest thing to see a loved one in pain.
Of course, suffering is shared, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, it seems that there's a, when things happen on the physical plane, that they have to be shared on the physical plane.
Right, yeah.
So Papa must have played the role of guru in sharing that load with yeah. Mother. Because I don't think Master, my sense is that it can't be done from beyond.
Well, these are really tough things, and we certainly talked about them a lot. But yeah, having a master there is undeniable. So many people nowadays have the other idea. Well, I mean, so many people have other ideas of and experiences with gurus who aren't in the body. So and even sharing pain of that sort. But at some level, it's all. Well, I think you're right in general, though, that the physical karma, physical, has to be gone through. And it can be shared. We know that Mother has shared people's pain.
Yeah.
In which she's felt the pain itself.
Yeah.
And not been relieved from the pain sometimes until she's told about who is having that pain. And then it leaves her quite quickly after that. But yes, Papa did something grand. You know, it's so interesting too. He had the ashram so developed that they didn't question him at all. There was no sense that anyone could, if Papa wanted her to be there, going through this and it being difficult for the ashram. No one questions Papa's judgment on that.
We think about the fact that stop everything, let's make a bucket brigade.
Yeah.
You know, to cool Mother. And you think about how many people that would have pulled away from other aspects.
Yeah. Yeah. Not to say some people didn't have those feelings and thoughts, but at the same time, Papa had such complete control of the situation. God put him in a position, and he'd been at the ashram so many years that he was ensconced as the true authority no one would question him.
I didn't unmute my mic properly before, but I was just saying that, remember in the incident that we have in chapter 3 where Mother's just saying the pain was too much, I can't bear it. And she put her hands on Papa.
Yeah, he took her, his hands. Yeah.
He fell down.
Yeah.
And, that's right. She took his hands and put them on her. That's right.
Right. Right.
And, so he obviously was taking on some pain at that point.
Right.
Well, and he may have been taking on prior who knows that he wasn't already taking 2/3 of it and that additional,
Although Mother explains him to be, has stories about him showing little compassion, or at least
right.
I think because you really recognize that you can maybe help, but then you might retard the potential, attainment of a soul too. So you really want them to own it, not to have it be a shared experience.
Yeah.
So for their own sake.
Yeah, so it may be the exact opposite of what I was saying.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt the gurus share. I'm not denying that. But at the same time, exactly how it's felt at the time by Mother, she felt that he wasn't helping her enough. So that means it was an extreme. She wasn't the kind of person to be to complain and to be a whiner necessarily in the rest of her earlier life.
That's where I'm wondering if if I'm, you know, if I'm backwards, and that it was that he was not taking on any of the physical.
Yeah.
Because he knew it was for her greatest good.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Christ atoned for the sins of the world.
Yeah.
Just Christ. They don't talk about John the Baptist kicking in or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Or his mother. How about Mary, you know, too? Her sharing showed to be only with him. Mm-hmm. But of course, in that sense, he was sharing everything.
Yeah.
But these are really mysterious things.
Sharing and observing is not necessarily the same as carrying.
True, but as I said earlier, the suffering that you feel, especially as a mother, that it is almost sometimes more difficult to take a child being a suffering. Now, and she's talking about an adult man, and he was completely established, so it wasn't the same. But certainly suffering of a mother or of someone close to you, if they're in pain, your suffering is of a different nature, but it is definitely excruciating sometimes. Because also you feel like you have nothing you can do about it. You don't see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Carla and David are coming to my mind.
Yeah.
I know that. Those last weeks.
I was thinking about when Mother was going through this horrible experience, Papa was looking on from the highest vantage point. So he saw that light at the end of the tunnel. He knew. He
right.
knew. So.
He knew. The thing is that Mother explains it so interestingly in that you don't know things necessarily other than what God gives you, which you have. And this is true of Papa for sure. No curiosity about things. But they're also the certainty that they have as an established, fully realized person. And, you know, they. Gurus will tell you if you're under the spell of something evil or something really other so that they can help you get through things. But rather, you know, to have the witness that, and to know that what she's going through is legitimate for her. That's probably the single biggest thing he did in a way was just to not remark upon it. Now I asked Swami Satchidananda that and he said, Papa made no comment. And that people there didn't know for years what was going on.
But he told her when she was, you know, in that earlier part that I read, what God has told you is absolutely true.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. She had maybe less doubt than some of the people, and she had plenty, but then there were some of the people who were there. But, you know, when you're under the tutelage of a guru like my papa, you really do just rest assured that it's being taken care of and that he's doing something that has to be done.
Well, you know, she did have a lot of assurance. What Jill just said, he confirmed it to her by saying it.
Yeah.
But also when she very first met him, she sat at his feet and had this tremendous uplifted experience.
Yeah.
And that's validation that she's in the presence of a God man. So before she even went to India, in fact, it probably precipitated her decision to go. She got all kinds of confirmation. That this was a tremendous God man. And, you know, she didn't go to India for her health. You know, she went there because she knew what Swami was.
Yeah.
And she got it. She got her money's worth, didn't she?
So
for sure.
Is there a place where Mother says specifically what God told her?
It's about her mission, my understanding, her mission and what she would attain.
But I'm wondering, does she ever say exactly what Papa was confirming?
Yes, she does say things like Kate said. You know, she said that she was seen as first of all, she talks about being a little drop of water, but she also talks about being confirmed as being the Divine Mother.
Yeah.
And that the whole world was her responsibility. So those were, although to answer your question, she didn't ever say this is the experience that happened in 1954, and here's what it was.
So, that's what I was wondering.
These are all just a little bit of guesswork on our part.
Yeah. So she doesn't ever spell out what it was Papa was confirming.
Well, other than what I just said.
I mean,
no.
Yeah, right. I was just curious as to whether there was any place.
It's an interesting point, though, because it's an omission on so many things that we omitted to, or didn't ask her about in more detail. But she could weave a world around you, or a state of consciousness around you that wouldn't allow you to to ask to remember things, and to or you just get to the point where you get to the state, and in the state where you don't have any curiosity about things as much as enjoying being with her.
Yeah.
It's a mysterious thing.
Yeah, where was I? Mira, were you following along? I think I turned the page.
I don't have my book this time with me.
Okay.
I think you're on 15.
Okay.
Way down.
I ask myself which master was the between the two.
Thank you. Thanks, Peter. I ask myself which master was the greater of the two, the one who nurtured me with love, who saved my life that I might come to this moment, the one who had the power to retain in all of their perfection the cells of his own body, or the one who had power to kill the ego, and then bring that one, which could be compared to Lazarus, back to life again. In the final analysis, I could not determine which was the greater of the two. I came to know, because one time toward the end of our sojourn there, Papa and Mother Krishnabai and I were alone in the room where I was, and I said to Papa, "Papa, you have your own special place in my heart. I have tremendous love for you, but I cannot accept you as my guru. Yogananda is my guru." Mother Krishnabai turned to him and she said, "What did she say?" In Kanaka. And he repeated what I had said. She said something to him in return. I said, "What did she say?" He said, "To tell you that we are but the two different sides of the one face of God." And I later came to see the absolute truth of this. Two fully realized God souls, each of whom did whatever that God, who is universal, required of them, that this soul might go through what it had to go through in order to speak the truth. I realized that it was his hand working everywhere. In every man, in every soul, I saw the universal Christ manifest as Christ consciousness every place. And I saw him manifested individually within myself and in every one of his creatures everywhere.
You know, it is so interesting to think that there's doubt every step of the way. You do get confirmation, and you do have high points, but that doubt assails us all the time.
I love that this book adds to the work of scripture that we can use to verify. It's the three ways to verify.
I was just thinking about when you talked about doubt, Larry. I'm listening to Swami Muktananda, as you know, right now, and He's talking about how all these years people will say the mantra, but there's always that barrier where they can't see God within.
Right.
That God is always separate.
That's right.
It's interesting, isn't it?
And, yeah, yeah.
And that's the doubt, isn't it?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the inability to know what state you've attained and God's unwillingness to share it with you by giving you great experiences and having you go over the top. But all is necessary, evidently. Some people go through these fantastic experiences all the way through and then attain, and others don't. It's a very strange thing to think about, that how some people don't talk about doubt, that's for sure. They don't seem to have any doubts, or they certainly don't talk about it, give it any energy whatsoever. But, you know, Mother said about Papa that he was so afraid of going to sleep because he might forget the mantra. He needed to have it going 24/7. And so, you know, we think of Papa as just barreling through, but even he had trouble with knowing he was doing what was necessary at the time and saying, oh, I hope I don't go to sleep. I've got to stay awake.
Yeah. Kind of feel like Mother was saying this one thing, but I asked myself which master was the greater. Mm-hmm. That in a sense, she was telling us that for us.
Hmm.
So that
good point.
You know, so that we knew as her disciples, it was the legacy she gave us, and from the two masters.
Right. Yeah. Well, she knows that these are questions that people ask about her, and she can hear it in people's, you know, when she's sitting in front of people, she can read people's minds or read people's thoughts on their face. But it's... And it's also, these are all natural human condition or human questions. So she needs to answer it to herself and certainly needs to answer it for us. So once we knew her, of course, she was all past that, but she still knew how to teach and she knew what was necessary to teach. You think about the people who knew Mother in the early days, and what they saw was so different than what we saw, a completed picture, you know. And they saw her in different states, but at the same time, as David always said, it's funny how much the stories that she tells in the early 60s versus the late 80s and the late 70s too, they are just identical to, I mean, within, at least on a spiritual level, because she would change a few, very few things over the years. I'll only give you an example, and I've mentioned it before. She, in the early 60s, thought that the Mount of Olives was the tonsils, because she was looking for allegorical connections in the body, and she was feeling all of this within herself. And then she later came to say, no, the olives are the eyes. The Mount of Olives are the eyes. So, and I don't know, I can't think of any other examples, but that one's always been there, that she did change her mind on how to interpret that correctly.
I don't know that Mother talked about it much, but just the act of separating from SRF to make this bold move.
Yeah, yeah.
To follow what, you know, she believed the scripture told to do, to go. And so she could fully experience the scriptures. And she couldn't have done that if she stayed, but the impetus it must have taken to the pressure she must have faced from that organization. And I mean, that's a crucifixion in itself, just leaving, I'm sure. And I bet she had doubts in that process as well. I'm sure people were doing their best to give her doubts in that process. Mm-hmm. And yet there she went. There she went.
Well, you know, before she left, she had no notion that she wasn't going to come back and still be part of SRF and have the center there and be responsible in that sense. But when she, I think it's funny, as you bring this up, she doesn't really talk about that very much, the shock of that letter. She received a letter while she was there. And, Kate, do you know the date of that? Because it was during, I think it was after her experiences. Or, you know, February 24th of 58 is the day that she's Papa put her into the more difficult experiences. And then she got that letter somewhere in that same area. I think my memory was...
Somebody forwarded it on, actually. But
Yeah, I'm sure, because it probably was sent to Seattle. Mm-hmm.
But remember, there were two reasons she was going. The one reason was that direction to go, and then the necessity of being with a master that could help her through these spiritual experiences. And the other thing was to get Papa's help about what to do about her master's work.
Right.
She actually, they had trunks. They had a big trunk of books of masters that they took with them to India. Hmm. And then Papa just said, let it all go. And nothing came of it. But I think she had the original autobiography and then what had been changed and some of the other things. And she was bringing it to Papa to show him and get his advice about it and all that. And that, that whole part of the trip just kind of went by the wayside, especially, I guess, once she was told that she was no longer a member or a center leader.
You know, I think that by the time she got that letter, she was realizing that everything was being taken from her. Everything in her whole life was being destroyed. So she had no confidence that she had, you know, could be, you know, dependent upon to do that anyway, physically or mentally or psychologically. Was she ready to do that? And when she went back in 1958, she still had 2 years before she came out of it. So she knew that that was a minor detail compared to what she was going through. But yeah, it must have been, though, on that particular day, something she and Father talked about. And it must have been devastating, too.
Bob, go.
Yeah.
Go.
I am.
But yeah, those are things that that really do fill in things, the story, the human aspect of Mother's life. So she had all of those things to deal with. This story, this book here, is got a lot of things that are strictly on the spiritual level, you know. It's mother's highest teachings.
You know, what I appreciate touches on is that she did this. So, you know, when we sit at the feet of Swamiji or whatever, you know, it's there's devotion, there's chanting, there's putting our minds on God, but the what's and the wherefores, you know, are not explained.
Yeah.
And that's what Mother is so incredibly good at, and why I'm so appreciative that you guys put this book together, is she really gets into the nuts and bolts. And the reason that that's important is when you get to the point where you're having that experience, you know, you go, aha, yeah, you know, this is part of being on the path. This is part of my development. And you're not horrified that something terrible is happening to you or that you're going crazy or whatever it might be. So one of the things that I've always been so appreciative is that both Mother and David were so articulate about explaining what a soul goes through. And according to Mother and her conversations with David, it is very similar. I mean, it doesn't have to be identical, but it very much follows the story of the Bible. And so these things that are told in the Bible about the crucifixion are very much what we go through, which is, you know, confirmation in and of itself. So, you know, Papa talked about confirmation of prophecy. One of the ways is to go to the scriptures. So we've got that confirmation in what Mother is telling us. We've got that confirmation from the Bible. And then once again, we have that confirmation in what David was telling us.
Right.
So we've had three confirmations. Very reassuring. And I don't know of anyone else on any other path that gets this level of detail that we get.
Now, there are books in India that do talk about these things, you know. Mother's Story is very much a Western, let's say, apprehension or, you know, moving into this world of spirit that is known in the East so intimately that they have a name of Kundalini for it. So Mother's remarkable translation of that word into crucifixion really puts everything on a different footing. Really does. Because
they might have explanations in India, but have you ever run across a spiritual master that does such an incredible job of explaining the parallels with the stories in the Bible?
No, true, yeah, right.
Well, and also because our scripture is the Bible and their scripture, you know, mm-hmm. they would maybe talk about it in terms of the Gita or talk about it in terms of the Upanishads.
Or, it's like they're using completely different words. I mean, yeah. It's like a completely different language.
Yeah.
It's like a different country.
They have a different word for every one of ours.
Exactly.
I always thought that was a good explanation. They have a different word for every one of ours. Think about it.
Well, that was Steve Martin's
review. Steve Martin.
He's over in France, you know, and he says they have a different word for everything.
But, you know, I promote a book called Guru now and then. It's written by Swami Muktananda of that area. Actually, he's from just north of Kerala. And his guru was
not our Swami Muktananda.
And that's right. So his guru was Swami Nityananda, who was from Kanagada and who knew, and they met Papa. In fact, they met one day. But the book Guru is explicit. It is terrifying. And it's also very uplifting. He went through just amazing, amazing experiences.
So if you read that, Larry, is it similar to Mother's Story?
No, because as you say, it was not the scriptures. He wasn't doing the scriptural comparison of what's going on within the body. But rather, he's using scriptures saying, well, this is what I went through as described in such and such. But he's not saying that the scripture is trying to tell us allegorically. He's talking about some of the Upanishads and some of the other scriptures that are explicit. They're not a story. They are explicitly talking about how to walk on water with Patanjali stuff and stuff like that. So I don't know the references. In fact, that's the difficult part about reading it, as I don't know where he gets these terms. But he says, I went through this certain pose, and he gives a name to it as though it's well understood and well established.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, but it is a great gift that he's given by virtue of his own experience.
Who is that?
Swami Muktananda.
Oh, thanks.
Muktananda from, he was actually in the West here too a few times. He traveled in the West. And Mother and Marge met him in, I think, Pune or Bombay somewhere. And Mother, just to, you know, be clear, I mean, Mother was a little skeptical of him. She didn't see him as being fully realized. But he definitely went through his guru. And similarly, too, here's the other interesting thing. He looked over the top of his head, and I've told you this all before, I know, but he breathed out this sigh, and that launched him into this experience. So
you're talking about Swami Nityananda.
This is Muktananda. Muktananda had a similar experience
those
on that.
Two?
Yeah. Okay. No, but not the one in Nandasram. No, I don't mean
right,
that.
Right, right,
this
right.
is, yeah, the one who wrote the book Guru.
Right, the other Muktananda.
There's lots of Muktanandas.
Yeah, there are lots of them, actually. But so, you know, this is the beginning of a new change in the West. This is what Master came to do, too. And this is what Mother, she didn't know that that's what she was going to do so explicitly. That's why God put her through it in the way that he did and took her to the Bible each time to show this so that she could teach from that perspective because she knew this is what Master wanted to do. This is what Babaji wanted the West to understand, that the height of the teachings there is a lot higher than they're giving it credit for. The body as a temple, too, is a really wonderful notion. Yeah, it's interesting to be at this stage and how many of us will come back to further the work on this, in this path. It's interesting to think. And what this work will be like in 100 years, 200 years.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Larry, because, you know, you read the news and, you know, it all seems so negative, yet we're assured that the world is evolving, spiritually evolving. And I find that enormously inspirational. So the news likes to latch on to bad things and negative things that happen throughout the world. I guess that's what sells the news, but isn't it wonderful that the world is evolving and people are becoming, you know, you look down through history and not too long ago and, you know, there was so much brutality, you know, people's lives were short and painful. And so I think it's good to keep that in mind amongst the onslaught of negativity that we hear every day from seemingly all news sources, no matter what their point of view is. So it's wonderful to think about this evolution.
Plus that with all the teachings we've been immersed in, we have no doubt that God wins. And we see the big plan, you know, we have to balance everything out. We've got our karma to pay and we have our karma to receive as rewards. So it's all part of the whole story, hey, for everybody.
It makes Larry's question quite exciting. What will this work look like in 100 or 200 years?
Yeah, it's very interesting to think about.
And to counter your all news is negative, look up the octopus rescue and see what you find. It's a nationwide sensation. And very positive.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. There's these videos that, you know how once you watch one and you give it a like, you get 15 more just like it, right? But these ones where they rescue these baby elephants or elephants, even like a younger bull elephant, get stuck in these ponds or get stuck in wire and they go through. And they're dangerous when they're trapped like that too. So it's certainly wonderful to watch. And then don't they have whales getting pushed back into the water? And it's pretty amazing.
And people really latch on to those stories because
really
it is uplifting and it shows a good That's nature right. in humans that we don't always get to see. It
shows
beautiful.
What we mostly see, though. What's mostly there is good nature.
Yeah.
It's when people talk about being afraid and being scared and all the bad news, I do this and knock on the glass. That's what's keeping anybody out of my house and taking all my things and hurting me. That's it.
And they don't.
So people are basically good.
That's right.
I always wonder what would happen if they only printed all the positives that happened. And, you know, it would just change our mindset. And I in this situation with my dad, it's like, you know, it's challenge and then we have a good day and challenge. And then I just tell my mom every day, like today was a bad day. I said, Mom, here's our blessings. This is what happened. A small minor thing, like I played cards with my dad and after lunch he said, okay, let's play another hand. I mean, he could hardly play, but, and I was helping him a lot. But you know, that's the blessing. He actually asked to play again. I said, that's good, Mom. You know, it's just focused on every day and then the whole day looks different. It's just amazing. And if we did that everywhere, like you say, why are we afraid? But people are so afraid. And I never know how to respond to that because that's not how I see life.
I know. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you don't have some kind of foundation, you know, we always think in terms of God and all that. But there's probably other foundations historically that have worked. But you have to have something to latch onto. And, you know, religion is probably the safest bet, but some people latch on to families, for instance. They see a family, well, look at royalty. They can look back at their family for 1,000 years. But, you know, even with a famous family that done a lot of good things and done a lot of things just famous for doing things that are good or bad, you still have this notion of your family and your community, perhaps, your tribe, your connection to a county, to a state, and to a country. So that seems to be sufficient for a lot of people. And they defend it pretty seriously. I think we're so kind of invaded by the intellectual class in nowadays, because once you learn to read, you're preyed upon by the intellectual class. So you think, oh, it would be wonderful to learn to read, but it really does open you up to it depends on how, there's so much stuff available now, but we still get somewhat siloed into certain things. And so we still choose a little bit of it based on that. But being able to read is a great, huge boon. But coming with it is also the introduction to things that maybe better not to know about or to think about for this lifetime. But certainly we live at a time where that is expected of us. It's especially those of us in the West. We are expected to be, we have every reason to believe that God did this on purpose to put us here at this time and to have this happen. So, but we can turn it all off. It's a superpower to not read things. And,
we have an obligation to have discernment, on what we take in and what we don't.
Right, right. Yeah, that's our responsibility.
You know, my kids used to, with their friends, they'd watch these horror movies, and I said, you guys, you can't get that out of your head once it's in there. And if you wake up in the middle of the night and you're scared out of your wits, I said, that's because of this input, put good things in your mind. And sometimes it takes us a while to figure that out,
I love David's story about him explaining the differences for different experiences as a human being. Is it something like you're in a very nice, beautiful Garden of Eden story that you're watching in a movie theater, and next door in another theater, people are making a bunch of noise and screaming and yelling, and you go over there and you try to convince them, oh, this is horrible. Come on out of here and come over to my side. Oh, no, they don't want to leave. they've bought into it so much. So I love his explanations.
You got to see how it turns out.
Yeah, you got to see. You're invested in it.
If you kind of observe people, they like being scared. There's an energy there. There's a thrill. They like drama. They like, a lot of the things that you see in the news that you, oh gosh, that's so negative. People sort of thrive on that. They get a kick. Mm-hmm. They get a lot of energy out of that. So sometimes it's good to do a little bit of self-analysis and say, what makes me feel good? What really feeds me? What's good for me? Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things about being on the path that hopefully you eventually learn is actually what's good for you and what isn't. Right. And you can do a lot of experiments. You can try, well, maybe I should just eat this entire half gallon of ice cream or whatever. Well, you do that and you go, okay, well, that experiment didn't work so well. So I think that's a big part of being on the path is figuring out what feeds you and lifts you up.
Yeah.
And what you need to leave behind, even though, like in the story of the Bhagavad Gita, they might be old friends. You might have to leave some old friends behind, or you might have to kill some of your very familiar relatives.
Well, even teachers and people that you admire individually as a character, you admire that character.
That helped you get to where you are.
Yeah.
But
they were instrumental. That were instrumental in your progress.
But that's an interesting story in general, isn't it? That we have the idea that we have loyalties to our friends and our mentors and our teachers. But we have, Krishna is telling us of a higher authority, a higher ownership that we have to pay to.
There comes a time, right?
Well, so in the story, he paints it as the one family against another family. So, and you're in this family, so therefore, you want the New York Yankees to win, for instance, as the old example. Just because you live in New York, well, that's a silly thing in a way. But it is funny. Now, of course, the Pandavas spent in the Bhagavad Gita's background is in the larger story in Mahabharata, is the notion that the Pandavas have tried to do the righteous thing, and the oldest son, Yudhishthira, is truly a noble, he's a Saint James character. He's the really righteous. Everyone loves him. He's like Rama a little bit. Arjuna is a very capable warrior, and each of them have different characters, but Yudhishthira is tremendous, tremendous king, effectively. And he's tried to do the best thing with the advice of Krishna. And each time, eventually it gets to the point where, as David pointed out recently, and that you don't even get one square. I wouldn't even give them one square inch of soil, the soil to have a village or anything like that. It's just these people are truly not cooperating with.
But I think the metaphor there, Larry, is that at that point, conflict becomes inevitable.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I'm talking about inside yourself. Like there's no way you can take a little bit of the old with you.
Right.
That has to be destroyed. That has to be defeated before you can progress. And even though you'd like to take your old habit.
Or it could be surrendered. If you think about it.
However it's defeated, it needs to be defeated. However it's left behind, it needs to be left behind.
But if they had surrendered, then it wouldn't have been. That's the sweet part. If the cousins had surrendered to the higher self.
So if the bad aspects of yourself just magically decide to surrender and fall off.
Now, remember in these stories, though, that there has to be the battle, and eventually there is the capitulation. Now, in the Mahabharata, it's quite amazing because it's so explicit. Bhishma is represented as the individual ego, and he's not able to be killed except by his own. He can only die by his own will. And this is another level of understanding of what we do. We still have to go through the battle. Bhishma did not give up until everything else was lost.
Well, here's what's interesting, Larry, is that in the stories, of course, in the story of the Bible and in the stories that we're talking about from India, you know, the good guys win and the story progresses. But in our own story, in any given lifetime, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. In any given lifetime, the bad guys can win.
Of course, yeah.
And we don't progress or we regress. Happens all the time. Ultimately, victory, as Krishna tells us, victory is assured. But not necessarily here and now.
Yeah, exactly.
Only if you make it so. Right. And that's why the will is so important.
Right.
Which is thrilling and terrifying. And we're all waiting to see how it turns out.
My mother commanded us to develop our wills to be strong, strong will.
Well, David used to say it takes a strong ego to go to God.
It has to be fully ripened or God's not interested.
Right. And it takes a strong ego to surrender, right?
It takes understanding too what you're about. You can't be a mentally deficient person and take full blame for something you do. They're talking about me again. But you know what I mean? In the sense that you have to be fully cognizant of what you're about and what's going on. So that's the other thing. And you recognize that you're still in the battle for your life. Very, very interesting. Mm-hmm. It's funny that Jesus is depicted in the way that he is in a way. He clearly is a warrior when God moves through him. He has the ability to do it. And he taught people and he worked against the demonic forces. So there's all of that going on. But once the battle was joined and he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, he surrendered to God and let the powers take him. But he represented something different than the things in the Mahabharata. That's the other thing. There are similarities to these stories, but they're not identical. And the Ramayana is different than the Mahabharata, but they deal with the same things. That battle has to take place.
And there's the idea, because the whole consummation is when the ego surrenders itself. The ego can't defeat itself, but it surrenders itself.
So the ego has to be strong when it engages in the battle, but then it has to give itself up.
That's a very good explanation, Kate. I think you're right.
God at that point.
Right.
Not my will, but thy will be done.
Yeah, it can't be surrendered until it's fully developed.
Yeah. What are you surrendering then? Yeah, it's burnt offerings up until if you do it, without engaging fully. Because you don't learn any other way. That's the other thing.
Christ doesn't surrender when he's halfway. He surrenders when he's just been accoladed.
Right. And then the battle is depicted to be taking place on the cross, all right. within. It's cordoned off into a single soul, as the way the story is told, but it still has correspondence in the Bhagavad Gita.
You know, Jill, that's a really, really good point that you just made, and it's a really relevant point as we come into the holy season, is that Christ came into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday.
Yeah.
And to a chorus of hosannas.
Yeah.
An acknowledgement that he was the Christed one. So that hadn't occurred to me until you just said that he had reached that pinnacle, and that's why he was ready.
Wow.
It wouldn't have made such an impact otherwise, would it?
Mm-hmm. No. Especially not on his disciples. I mean, that made a tremendous impact on them, that they thought he was, being crowned king, and
Rama was going to be crowned king, and Duryodhana was the beloved king.
It was this close.
No, it was done. I mean, it's
I'm thinking of any other spiritual scriptures that, like in the Quran, I don't know of a battle, or. And I'm not familiar with the Quran.
Nor am I.
Maybe
no,
somebody,
it should be.
Someone else is. But it makes me wonder, in the other great religions of the world, is there a similar battle, interior or allegory?
I wonder if Buddhism might be a place to look.
Well, Buddha has that fight with Mara, you know, in which all the temptations of the world are brought in front of him. And it's all done as though it's in an inner battle, and those kinds of things are all brought forth powerfully against him.
Mm-hmm. And again, Muhammad entreats people to go to battle against the
jihad, yeah.
Yeah, the jihad.
Yeah, the energy.
Too bad they externalize that so well.
they really do have a high teaching in Islam.
Most Muslims do not. I mean, do not externalize it. That's that small portion. Keeping the good news good.
Well, I mean, there's always different levels of understanding and practice, and there's always going to be that with every religion. So
it's the holy month of Ramadan, though. So lots of people are doing lots of beautiful sacrifice right now.
Yeah. You know, I always go back. We had in Jerusalem, we had just a really nice couple experiences with Muslims, and just also smiling and more engaged with us tourists. But I just always remember this man, older man, probably 10 years older than us, who asked us where we were going, and we told him. I forget what else he talked about. Oh boy, Kate, maybe you do. But he told us where to turn once he found out where we were going. And we missed it. And so he had walked by on an adjacent street, thinking we might miss it because it wasn't language. He spoke pretty well. But he knows.
We were trying to get out to a bus station that would take us up to Mount of Olives.
He did explain it perfectly. Once we saw the portal, the doorway, the gate, exactly one of the gates on the, on the west side. And, he explained it once he saw the thing. Oh, I see now what you're talking about. But he went along an adjacent street and showed up right when we were going to make the wrong turn. But I just remember that smile of his. And it wasn't like, oh, you stupid tourist at all. It was just my duty. He felt that he was retired. He didn't have anything to do today. He had that notion anyway, very, very calm. It wasn't like a spiritual thing, but it was just a kindness. Very interesting. And in the bus too, we felt perfectly comfortable and
safe. We found out afterwards we weren't supposed to, as tourists, go on that bus, so that it was considered dangerous to be going out that gate and getting on that bus, because you actually go into the Palestinian Authority.
I think it might be more for Jews, yeah, and they could tell we were Americans, and most likely.
But they said even as tourists we shouldn't be doing it. But we
didn't know that till after.
A lot of people, you know, two people looking at us, and then a lot of people, once you looked at them and smiled, they'd smile. And,
well, and each one of them gave directions when we asked, too, every time, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Larry, maybe I'm bringing up something that I shouldn't, but I was wondering if you had any sense of what we're going to do next week. We've talked about it a little bit, but I'm
wondering. Yeah.
Because we remember we started on chapter 3, everybody, and then we came back around, after all, on this book.
Yeah, we had some ideas a while ago, and I don't remember right now, but I'm sure they'll come back. We'll think of something.
We could talk about doing the Holy Science.
The Holy Science, for sure. Yeah, that probably makes the most sense. We had a couple interim ones, though, that would relate to this. Well, I don't remember now what they were. I wrote them down, so I'll send you, when I send out the message next week.
We're doing the Holy Science after Easter, and going to be one other thing that we do next week.
Or maybe even as after Swamiji's come and gone, too, because we have a lot going on with until June. It might be easier just to focus on that in the fall, or with an unbroken period in front of us. So we're trying to get some things done for Swamiji's. Kate's been really good at getting everything organized. Mm-hmm. And I've been working on some videos that we took during, we both wonder why we never wrote very much about the ashram and where, when we were in Chennai, and where we haven't written about being in Ranchi either yet. But we have those kinds of things to do, and they could be alternative things we could do. But the thing I'm thinking about right now is to get people an understanding of Swami Muktananda, what he's like, who he is. And as Judy said, you know, she's doing some reviewing of some subtitles that we had done, captions for Swamiji. He speaks very clearly, but it's nice to have the subtitles. And so she's reviewing the subtitles and fixing the different words. They do strange things with words that, and you know, I must be that the transcribers, they must only listen to it once, and they've got to get it down and do the best they can and not try to make everything perfect. Because it's some of the things, if you listen to them twice, I don't know why that they would have gotten them wrong. But anyway, she's working through that. So we're trying to present Swamiji in a light that's, you know, good. And also to show people who don't know him what he's like, what exactly he might be offering too, in terms of giving talks or talking about Papa and the teachings that he's so familiar with. So we have some great videos of him. And then we have one other kind of a treat video that I've just about completed, but Kate and I have to listen to the captions and get them right. And that is a Swami named Padmanabhananda. So I'll explain that later when you see the first video come out. But we wanted to get one of Swamiji first, Swami Muktananda, to put that out first rather than Swami Padmanabhananda. Because Kate and I, when we first heard that talk on the 28th, we knew that was a wonderful talk. And if it was available, we would excerpt it. And it's quite nice. But it's all, in listening to it again recently, it's quite obvious that this, he speaks a lot of Sanskrit words. And so the transcriber just puts in speaking and they know it's a pretty good, probably the better transcriber, by the way, than you have to deal with, Judy, because this person seems to know all the Indian words really well. Mm. So it's very beneficial to hear that it is Hindi or Sanskrit. And then we also have a translation of the invocation. So I'll be able to put that up. So I would say about a third of the talk is he speaking Sanskrit, but he immediately translates it. And what you'll love about him is just that he's a natural speaker, not like he's a play, you know, he doesn't make a big deep production about it, but he has a very sweet demeanor and very sweet man, and he's a wonderful storyteller. He really, and he's got so many stories. And this is done on the day after the big event on the 27th, and they're both relaxed, and he's just in his element. So I think you'll enjoy that, to get a feeling for what that experience we had. But the more important thing is that I want to get is Swami Muktananda, an understanding for everyone to, who don't know him, and whether, well, do I want to come, or that kind of thing. People to recognize this guy is something else. He's quite amazing. And he's so different than Papa, than Mataji, Swamiji. He's just so different, the way that he thinks, but he's got a great purity and he's got a great understanding, and he speaks really well. And you sometimes have to hear them a couple times, but he really has some brilliant ways of describing the spiritual path and what it's about. He's really quite brilliant and such a warm person.
And the way he uses his hands when he's talking.
Yeah.
And,
beautiful voice.
Yeah, he does have that beautiful voice, yeah.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about during this talk that you've given me to review, at one point he puts on Papa's initiation.
Oh, yes, we should talk about that, yeah.
And when he's listening to Papa, he's very much in it.
Yeah.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, it's as if he's being initiated for the first time.
Yeah.
And he's just drawn within. It's just beautiful. Can I tell a quick little story, Larry?
Oh, please do, yeah.
Okay, this happened the only time I went to an Anandashram, and Jill was witness. It was my birthday, and because it was my birthday, people put me at the head of the line for the flower ceremony.
Oh, yeah, and you get a bigger bunch.
But I got the garland, garland.
Right.
And I had never seen what people do with the flower garland.
Right.
At all.
I know, we know nothing, do we? Us Westerners have no idea what to do.
Well, I put it on me. I started putting it on me, and Swami Muktananda started laughing. He's there. No. He's laughing, saying, no. That was hilarious, you know. But he was so loving. And then
I know, they're not like, oh, it's the end of the world for you. They never try to embarrass anyone. I know, Swamiji.
And then he gave it to me.
Oh, nice.
And so I brought it to my room and put it around David and Mother's picture.
Oh, I see.
Oh. Larry, would you maybe consider that's what we could talk about next week and for several weeks is maybe showing some.
No, that's a great.
I think that was one of the things we talked about, Larry and I talked about, but I didn't want to just say it right now in case.
And I know which one we're going to start with too, because Kate and I just watched it. It's about, is it 7 or 8 minutes long? I just don't want you to worry or think about it too much. It'll blow your mind. It's truly wonderful. By the way, Judy, it's an excerpt. It comes from the one you're doing now. It's, when he talks about his mother, so it's quite beautiful.
I will do the, I'll finish up the captions for that because we see that there's some mistakes in that one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's a great idea.
I sent that to one of the people that I'm contacting to get a venue here, and just so they know who Swami Muktananda is. And one person I called up from the Vedanta Society, and I said, I'm just wondering if you would like to have somebody come and speak to you. There's a Swami coming. We're hosting the Swami coming in. And I said, Swami Muktananda. Oh, which Swami Muktananda would that be? I said, oh, he's from Anand Ashram in Kerala. Oh, yes. Well, yes, send me the material. Yes, we might.
And so, his first time in the West. Yeah,
yeah. Exactly. So then he said, well, can he come on the day that's our retreat day? And I said, I had given him some other days. He said, oh, I'd love him to come that day. And I said, no, we've already got him for that day. And he said, well, I'll work with those other days. I'll get back to you. So, but it's nice to that he is, you know, is known among some circles, and the ashram is, yeah. So.
All right. Well, that sounds like a plan. We worked that out. That's great. It's almost 9, so. Let's see our closing prayer. Mother's closing prayer. Mm-hmm. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart
is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
And surrender myself to thee.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging
in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind
and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
For my communion.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am
He. Om. Om. Peace.
Peace.
Peace. Bliss.